You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 26, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, folks. I am not here. Neither is Matt and Michael. We are taking a well-deserved break, but that doesn't mean that we don't have all new content for you, although it's not all new. Some of it's new, and some of it is archived content. Today on the program, Dan Cantor, the executive director of the Working Families Party, on the issues the Working Family Party is working on in a couple of states around the country and why you should be interested in this party. Also on this program and from our archives, Richard Heinberg on the end of growth. And members today will hear a deep archive show. Zach Galifianakis appearing on the very first iteration of the Majority Report back in December of 04. That's right, December 2004. Zach Galifianakis. Tomorrow on the program, Wednesday the 27th, we'll only have a member show. Sorry, freeloaders. But members will enjoy listening to an interview I did with Tracy Weber of ProPublica and one that Janine and I did with Tony Jutt back in June of 2004, that the late Tony Jutt. A great interview and something that you'll enjoy. Then on Thursday of this week, all new material for you. I interviewed Stephen Brill for Ring of Fire. I did some additional time with him for this program. You will hear that interview in its entirety. He's got a blockbuster piece in Time magazine. Check it out on Thursday, Stephen Brill. Also on this program on Thursday, for you freeloaders and for members, of course, you'll also hear from James Kimmey. He is a former operations director of at the St. Louis University Hospital. He basically tells me a lot of the same things Stephen Brill does from a different perspective. And so if you want to know what is driving the number one driver of our debt, if that's what you're so concerned about, and our deficits going forward into the future, the number one problem that we have with healthcare in this country, it is healthcare costs. And between Stephen Brill, his blockbuster piece in Time magazine, and James Kimmey, you will know everything there is to know about it. So tune in on Thursday. In the meantime, today, enjoy what we've got for you, and talk to you later.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Joining me now is Dan Cantor. He's the executive director of the Working Families Party. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Dan, just to give us, before we get into some of the issues that you guys are promoting, let's talk a little bit about the Working Families Party. I'm familiar with it. I'm from New York State. I always vote on the Working Families Party ticket. We have fusion voting in this state, and so it gives me the opportunity of of voting for a candidate and not empowering candidates I don't want to win, but at the same time also strengthening and reinforcing that there are political issues that I'm more aligned, frankly, with the Working Families Party. Tell us more about the party.
Sure. That's a good, quick explanation. And Working Families Party is organized in half a dozen states. And it uses, in some of those states, that system you described, the fusion voting system, that essentially allows third parties to overcome the traditional problems that otherwise plague third parties under the American system, namely the wasted vote problem or the spoiler problem that your listeners are probably familiar with, you know, from the 2000 election, shall we say. So in New York and Connecticut, in Oregon and South Carolina and Vermont, those are states that allow cross-endorsement or fusion voting, in which a candidate can appear under two different labels or two different designations on the ballot. And in a sense, it allows a voter to cast a vote with a little more meaning. Barack Obama ran for president on the Working Families Party line. Of course, he was also a Democrat in New York. And we said to voters, if you want to really underline your support for jobs and sustainability and healthcare and so on, vote for him on the Working Families line and, you know, carry that message forward. And about 250,000 people did, so that was very satisfying for us. In other states, Working Families Party operates much more as kind of an outside force that is attempting to push Democrats in what we take to be a sensible, humane, progressive direction. Don't have ballot line in other states because they don't permit the cross-endorsement system. But you can still do a lot of very good work. So in New Jersey, in Maryland, some other places where there are organizing committees, we are trying to advance what we think of and what I'm guessing you think of as common sense progressive politics. So we try to get the best Democrats we can elected, but we don't just leave them in office. You know, then it's all about providing them with the support up that makes them govern in the way we need them to govern.
Now,
so that's the WFP.
How does it get? Well, you know, it's an interesting dynamic because I'm curious now. Should I register? Here's the question I've always had: is that should I register in New York State? And it may not be the same situation, obviously, in others, but in New York State,
should
I register as a Working Families Party member? Because
We don't really care if you do or not, to be honest, because that takes you out of the Democratic primary, and that's where a lot of the action is.
Right.
What we want you to do is, whether you're a registered WFP or registered Democrat, is if you're a registered D, in those important primary elections, we hope you'll vote for the candidate who also has the support of Working Families, because that becomes your kind of good housekeeping seal of approval that candidate, who is supported by this broad coalition of community and labor and green and civil rights and so on organizations, is A, viable, and B, shares your values. So that's what's important here. The task of progressives in America is to yank the Democrats, to stop the Democrats from going off the cliff. That's what we're all trying to figure out. Working Families has a particular approach, which has to do with trying to get very good people into the candidate pipeline early. Train lots of campaign managers and communications directors and so on, advance a common sense set of issues that we think are really, really popular, but don't get heard over the money din and the media din that always wants to focus just on the horse race. So we think of ourselves as values and issues based, but very competent.
And one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you this week is I've been making a point of talking to folks from organizations, institutions that are really pushing back. This may be the last window, knock on wood, let's hope, for any type of a grand bargain to take place that would involve the cutting of social insurance benefits, entitlement reform, whatever you want to call it. This
exactly.
may be the last opportunity, and I know you guys have been heavily involved in this fight. Just tell me about what you guys have been doing on that accord.
Well, like a lot of people, we don't want a grand bargain if it's a bad bargain. And so we have been pushing the members of Congress in the states we're active in, and again, it's about half a dozen, to reject the notion that this is what's required. We are strongly in favor of maintaining those social insurance programs, not cutting them because we enjoy some, you know, mythical need to, quote-unquote, reassure the markets. We think that's silly. We think most voters know it's silly, but again, it's the conventional wisdom in the corporate press, so we have to push back against it all the time. This is the task of progressives, right? We have to make – there is a bluish majority in America. That was obvious in the last election, even if the gerrymander protected the Republicans in the House. But just because there's a bluish majority doesn't mean it's deep blue, by which I mean progressive. That's our task. How do we turn blue states into deep blue states, purple states into blue states, red states into purple, and so on and so forth, and show that we can govern in a way that makes people's lives better? We want to move – we don't just want to have grievances. We want to actually govern. And we think there's a cornucopia of good ideas about what one could do to make people's lives a little bit less mean, to, you know, take care of this this only planet that we have.
All right. There's two other issues I wanted to talk to you about that I'm interested in. One is that I know you're working on, I think, in about three different states, the issue of paid sick days. This is a big – this is turning out to be a big issue, particularly in the New York mayor's race. But tell me on what level you guys are working on this and about the issue itself. I mean, it seems rather obvious to me. When I go to a restaurant, I want to get the food, not the flu, essentially, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Listen, paid sick time, paid sick days is an issue whose time has come. The Portland City Council just passed it the other day. I think they're the fourth city in America to do so, led by Family Forward Oregon and with a good assist from the Oregon Working Families Party. Here in New York, New York WFP is leading the charge with some terrific allies as well. Listen, this is – most people can't believe that some enormous percentage, 30-40% of American workers, receive no paid sick time. If they're out sick, they lose a day's pay. So as you point out, what that means in the food service industry is people go to work sick, and that's about the last place you want to see that. So this is you know, it's hard to get these kinds of advances, one, but at some point you get enough cities and enough states doing it. Connecticut did it, where it was again led by Connecticut WFP, and that's the first state to make this a right of employment. Once we get to enough of them, then the dominoes will fall, and this will eventually become part of the social employment contract in America, or so we hope.
You know,
same thing on minimum wage. You know, minimum wage took years and years to get. Now we have to fight to get it increased. Here we're getting a good assist from the president, but it's the same kind of fight. How do we make universal standards, the floor, a little bit higher?
You know, the paid 6 days. The reason why I love this issue, or you know, I think it's so important, is that it really is one of those arguing with libertarians is one of my bailiwicks, and there is no. There is no – it is the perfect example, it seems to me, of why the libertarian ideology fails. There is no – there's no incentive for the worker per se to stay home when they're sick because they're going to lose pay. There's no incentive for the restaurant owner, let's say, to give paid sick days, theoretically, because if we're talking only about profit motive or this short-term profit, because, you know, they're going to be paying for a worker who's not there. But it is so clear that is in society's best interest and in the long-range benefits of these other entities, but particularly society. I mean, because, you know... I guess theoretically, you know, your server could come up to you at a table and say, just want to let you know before I tell you the specials, I'm deathly ill, and I have the flu, and I may have strep. So today on the menu, we also have a, you know, an onion soup. And, you know, so this is one of those examples where you need, if employers don't see the value of it in themselves, we're all sort of paying for this.
That's correct, and this happens time after time after time. You know, once you make the argument to people, opposition you know, melts away except from the more retrograde elements in the society. The fast food industry is very hostile to this because, you know, their profit margin will decline a little bit, or they'll have to raise the price of a hamburger a nickel. Our view is society ought to be willing to accept that so that we can raise the level of decency in everybody's lives. You know, we don't want a society that only works for the, you know, the well-connected and the wealthy. We have to think about the broad obligations we have to each other.
I want to make a point, too, about this raising the price of a hamburger and nickel. I don't believe that there is any data to substantiate that you're going to be pricing people out of a hamburger when you raise it a nickel. And we are talking, literally, you'd have to raise it maybe a nickel, maybe a little bit less. The issue
Probably less.
But let's just say even a nickel. The elasticity of a hamburger in the marketplace is not such that a nickel is going to make a difference. The real reason why major corporations like this don't want something like this is that we know that major corporations really build their profits on cutting costs. And what they really want to do is make sure that their labor costs are as low as possible. So they're driving down wages. They're driving down benefits. This is a really important issue. And so let's say anybody in our now, is this is Working Families Party working on this in New York State wide or just New York City at this point?
We're working on it in New York City right now. We're hoping to have a vote soon. There's a hearing this week, in fact, on the legislation. It's been a long campaign. We wish it had passed sooner. We have a supermajority support on the city council, 34 or 36 of 51, but the speaker, who controls the floor calendar, has so far not permitted a vote. We're hoping to change her mind on that soon. Now, obviously, she's a leading candidate for mayor. So we hope the value of this is not lost on anyone.
Right.
In Portland, as I said, they just passed it. In Philadelphia, there's a coalition working there on this, and they just passed it at the – or are about to pass it at city council. So this is an issue that has some legs. Orlando is looking at some stuff. You know, it's one of those things that, like the old living wage campaigns, you know, that swept across the country a decade or so ago, this makes sense to people. Yes, of course everybody should have nobody wants that special side order of flu that you
right.
just
exactly.
Painted a picture of.
All right. Let's...
So there are a lot of things like that we should be focused on, though not only these issues.
All right. Let's just turn to one other issue that's really important in my mind. In fact, I think it could be one of the most crucial issues in terms of our democracy is public financing of campaigns. I know that you guys are working hard on this in New York. Tell me about that.
Well, so this is our number one issue for the year, has been for a couple of years. You know, there used to be a saying among democracy reform types that campaign finance reform is nobody's number one issue, but it ought to be everybody's number two issue. I think we've reached a point where it's a lot of people's number one issue.
Yeah.
Because we can't get anything done. We're blocked. You want to deal with climate change? We don't have a prayer as long as the fossil fuel industry controls and can purchase elections. You want to deal with living standards? It's pretty tough when Walmart is able to write enormous checks all over the country, and the Koch brothers, not just them. It's a system that is rotten with the influence of private money. We have a very exciting campaign in New York, Citizen Action of New York, Working Families, Brennan Center, scores of organizations involved that is attempting to establish a statewide system of public funding of elections based on the system we have in New York City. It's a matching system. So if somebody's running for a state assembly and they would come to you, Sam, and say, you know, can you give me $50? And you say, I can give you $30. They say, great. The city, the state would then match that $30, 6-1. State gives them $180. You give your $30, and that's a $210 contribution. You could run campaigns on $30 contributions and $20 contributions when there's a matching system. And if you can't go find, if the candidate can't go find a few hundred people to give them $20, they probably have no business running for office to begin with. So we think this gets people to have skin in the game. It's cognizant of the fact that we're never going to get money out of politics. Private money will always find a way. The goal is not to get private money out. It's to get public money in. And when you do that, you reduce the relative advantage that wealth has. and you get better people running for office. You get people running who never would have thought they could run for office. And in so doing, you know, you make democracy stronger. We think there's nothing more important than changing the rules of the game, because when you change the rules and you make the rules better, you get better outcomes.
You're essentially changing the noise to signal ratio, I guess, of private money versus public money. And so and where are you? I mean, where does this stand in New York? I mean, where are we in terms of, like,
we are close, but we're not done, but not by a long shot. This is a very, very heavy lift, because you're asking elected officials, even many of whom know that the system is bad and they spend way too much time worrying about fundraising, they have at least succeeded under it. They have thrived.
And right.
So we're asking them to jump in the water anyway. Governor Cuomo has put forward a quite strong call in favor of this. The Speaker of the Assembly himself has been a champion of this for 20 years, so he has endorsed it. The big fight will be in the New York State Senate, where we have this odd Democrat-Republican coalition leadership. But even there, we believe we either have the votes or we're so close that we can get the last one or two that we need. It will depend in some substantial measure on the governor. We're counting on him to rally the populace and use his quite considerable talent to get this over the finish line. It's a very exciting effort.
And we should say that New York, if this is something that could pass in New York, it then becomes a template, obviously, for the rest of the country.
Well, it's a big state. I mean, and there's some big national forces, you know, the Sierra Club and the NAACP and Greenpeace and Communications Workers of America, and lots of different people are throwing in on this effort in New York, because for exactly the reason you mentioned. If this can get done in a big state, it can spread, and eventually we'll have public funding of elections for Congress, but we'll start at the state level.
Great. Well, Dan Cantor, Executive Director of Working Family Party, tell us how, if people want to get involved with the Working Family Party, want to try and bring it to their state, help out what you're doing, where can people get more information?
The more information is, unsurprisingly, at our website, workingfamilies.org.
You guys have one of those website things?
One of those websites, yes. It's an internet thing.
Okay.
So we welcome that, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things.
We will link to it. And what is the URL again? I'm sorry.
Www.workingfamilies.org.
And we will link to that at majority.fm. Dan Cantor, Executive Director of the Working Families Party, thanks so much for joining us.
Really appreciate it. Take care.
On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Richard Heinberg. He is a senior fellow in residence at the Post Carbon Institute in California, author of many books, actually, and his most recent is The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Welcome to the program, Richard.
It's good to be with you, Sam. Thanks.
So now I got to tell you, the we have a couple of listeners who really suggested that we should talk, and you have a theory that is not necessarily as controversial as it certainly as once was, But you make the argument in The End of Growth that, in fact, what we are experiencing in terms of our economic problems are more, I guess, structural, and even in a larger way than just the way that economists usually talk about structural problems in our economy, but that, in fact, the engine for growth that has been supporting our country for 70 years has essentially, I guess, run out of fuel.
Yeah, that's a very apt metaphor. In the book, I argue that growth is unsustainable over the long run in any case, because it inevitably entails increased use of energy and resources, and we do live on a finite planet. So at some point, growth has to stop and perhaps even reverse. But I guess the question is, how close are we to that point? And in the book, I argue that the U.S. has effectively reached that point, European countries as well, and we're effectively leading the rest of the world into the post-growth era as a result of the convergence of three factors that I call the three Ds: debt, depletion, and disaster. And it can take a couple of minutes to unpack each of those three Ds. So any place you'd like to start, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, well, let's start. And before we get to the three Ds there, let's just go backwards a little bit and talk about the sort of the typical perspective that we have in terms of growth in this country.
Sure.
I mean, give me your sense of what the argument is about generally. The one that is sort of like contends that we can have infinite growth.
Right. Well, over the course of the last few decades, we've benefited from an extraordinary bonus of cheap energy. And that enabled us to do a lot of things with cheap oil, coal, and natural gas. We were able to make stuff faster than we'd ever been able to make it before and invent all kinds of new ways of using this cheap energy. And that gave us enormous economic benefits. And that was the growth era. And economists saw this, and they attributed it not to energy and raw materials and so on, but solely to the magic of the market. And they believed, therefore, that growth could continue forever. Now, it's kind of an absurd idea. Let's use a simple example. A hamster, when it's first born, grows very rapidly, and so it's doubling its weight every week. Now, what would happen if a hypothetical hamster were able to continue doubling its weight every week for an entire year? How big a hamster would we have? Well, answer is we'd have a 9-billion-ton hamster. Things like that don't happen in nature because there are natural limiting factors that keep growth from going on forever. Well, it's the same with economies. It's just that economists have never stopped to ask the question, how big can an economy get? How big should it get? How big an economy can the Earth support? That's just not part of their worldview. But I think those questions are extremely relevant today because we have economies that have gotten so big that, in fact, they're bumping up against natural limits all over the place.
Now, certainly in this country, I think it's not controversial to say that insofar as that the benefits of growth have been distributed, or let me put it this way, that much of the growth that we have seen in this country has come from the underlying argument you're making is that it has come from this incredibly cheap and up until recently abundant resource, this cheap source of energy. And we've also seen that growth in this country was a function of cheap credit, that what was lost in terms of across the population in terms of wages and a relationship between sort of wages and productivity was made up for by cheap credit, which was essentially just borrowing against the future. And
that's exactly right.
And people did this both in sort of a in the way that we understand it conventionally speaking, spending money that supposedly will come down the pike, but also expending in your theory the cheap energy that we weren't quite pacing ourselves because it's not a finite resource. And I think obviously the notion that we can continue to grow on a planet that is finite, at one point it's not going to work. And I guess really the question is that you're arguing is that we are essentially at that point. Is that accurate?
That's right. Yeah, you mentioned credit, and let me just unpack that for a moment. In the early 20th century, with cheap fossil fuels, the biggest problem we had was that of overproduction. We could make stuff faster than people could buy it, and people were accustomed to buying things with cash. So we solved that problem of overproduction in two ways. First, with advertising to talk people into wanting more stuff, and then with consumer credit to make it easier for people to go into debt to buy more stuff than they could consume at any one point. So for the first few decades of the century, our motto was consume now, pay later. Well, now it's later. We've gotten to the point now where the economy is seizing up for a series of reasons, that the 3 Ds again. And as that happens, all of these debts start to come due at the same time. And there's not enough new credit to be able to pay off that debt. And that's the situation that we're facing. Well, in Europe, for example, it's being called a growth crisis. The sovereign debt of all of these countries that are in trouble, Greece, Italy, Spain, and so on, was taken on at a time when the economies were growing rapidly, and it seemed as though that debt could easily be paid off. But now that growth has slowed down, these countries find themselves with a millstone around their necks, and it's not clear how they're going to get out of this situation.
And so, so let's talk about debt depletion and disaster. What are those three? I mean, you've talked about debt.
Yes.
And when you talk about debt, I mean, you're really talking about the fact that these economies that we're discussing have run on consumer spending, or at least have grown,
right,
or much of their growth has come from consumer spending. I know at least in this country it's 70% of our growth comes from that. And that because to a certain extent we're going through a period of deleveraging, people simply aren't buying, and because we have such incredible unemployment, people don't have the resources to buy and drive this economy. Is that essentially the debt that you're talking about?
That's very accurate. And when you look at the demographic situation with the baby boom entering retirement years, where they're going to be consuming less and saving more, there's really no basis for a recovery within the economy itself. I mean, there's no likely return of high housing prices that people can use as the basis for increasing consumer debt. So we're sort of stuck in the water without a paddle.
And so let's move to depletion. Let's stay on debt for a second, because I believe that at the very least, right now, the U.S. government should be going further into debt. And can go into further into debt because we control our own currency. We have a different dynamic than the Greeks, for instance.
And debt is cheap for the U.S. right now because the U.S. dollar is still the world's reserve currency.
Right, and we can get we can borrow money in the form of when we issue treasury bonds, 10, 20, 30-year bonds at an all-time low. But your argument is that even if we were to do that, take on this debt, and politically this is impossible now, or sadly impossible
yeah.
now. But the U.S. government was to say, okay, we're going to start another WPA. We're going to hire 4 million people, 5 million people to build our infrastructure, or to create the means in which we are expending less energy, but still manage to have productivity. Do you think that second part is even possible?
Well, you know, I think that it would be advisable, in fact, for governments to take on a bit more debt at this point in order to fund the kinds of projects you're talking about. We need infrastructure in place to help the country function well in a situation with low or even negative growth over the next few decades. It's going to be a different kind of infrastructure from what we've had in the past. Instead of building more highways, we need more local public transit. We need more local food. We need, in fact, really a guarantee of the basics for the population, because unemployment is not going to go away. So we need guarantees for people of access to food, water, basic medical care, shelter, and so on. In order to avert the kind of unraveling social sphere that we're seeing in so many countries in North Africa, the Middle East, and so on, that's going to happen in this country as well, unless we're able to guarantee the basics.
And so, when you're talking about debt, you're talking about the long-term incapacity for the individuals in our society, essentially, to be able to generate growth. And in some respects, when you're advocating for those measures to be taken on by our governments, in some ways you're talking about providing a soft landing.
That's right. Yeah, and we're on course for a very hard landing right now, because there is very little social safety net in this country, a bit more in some other countries around the world. But if the economy really starts to come apart at the seams the way it began to do in 2007, 2008, if that process starts again, which it seems very likely to do, we don't have very much of a backup, and it seems as though we're facing not only economic but also social unraveling.
Let's talk about the notion of depletion. Now, we hit peak oil in this country, I think it was around 1972. If I'm not mistaken, and people forget
that
the United States was the primary source of oil for at least
for the world for at least
50, 60 years, I guess, in the last century.
That's right. Yes, the U.S. was not only the world's foremost oil producing nation. We were also the world's foremost oil exporting nation. We were producing half the world's oil in many of those years. But that changed in 1970. Since then, we've become the world's foremost oil importing nation. And it's not just because of EPA regulations or environmentalists. Fact is, we've sunk more exploratory wells in the United States than in the rest of the world put together. This is a fully mature oil-producing province. That's not to say we'll never discover more oil in the United States. It's being discovered all the time, but much smaller pockets. And what we're finding these days typically is oil that's much more expensive and slow to produce. So the result of that is higher oil prices, and we're seeing oil prices today in the range of $100 a barrel, roughly three or four times what was being forecast just a few years ago that we would see today. And that's having a constricting impact on economic growth. We see it in recent economic history. Every time we've had an oil price spike in the last 40 years, we've had a recession immediately following. And that certainly was the case in 2008 when we saw the oil price spike up to $147 a barrel. Immediately, the world economy went into recession. And we're just barely pulling out of that now, but the oil price is back up to $100 a barrel, and that's really preventing the economy from recovering. That's not my opinion. The International Energy Agency has said effectively the same thing, and there are a number of economic analysts who've come to the same conclusion.
Now, just to give me your sense, I mean, I imagine you have a better sense of this than I, and certainly I imagine at one point over the next year we're going to hear quite a bit about this, but I think it's in the Dakotas that there's a big they're pulling a lot of like a shale oil out of or oil that they're extracting from shale.
Yes, the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. They're using the same fracking technology that's being used with natural gas in several parts of the U.S., in Texas and in Pennsylvania, various places. Basically the same technology, horizontal drilling and the injection of special chemicals to fracture the rock of low permeability, mostly shale. And what's being achieved with that is a production of a little less than 500,000 barrels a day in North Dakota, which is turning North Dakota into, you know, a real boom town. And there are a lot of claims being made that this is going to turn around our situation in the U.S. and the world, that we'll have lots of plentiful cheap oil as a result of this. What people who say these things don't understand is that this is inherently expensive oil, and it's going to be slow to produce. 500,000 barrels a day from North Dakota seems really good until you realize that the U.S. imports, oh, something like 10 or 12 million barrels every day. So 500,000 barrels a day, that's it helps in the margins, and that will probably continue to increase for a few years. But it's not going to change the fundamental equation, which is that we've used up the cheap, easy stuff. The low-hanging fruit are gone. And even though we will be finding and producing more oil, it's going to be from lower quality resources. And if the price of oil for some reason goes down as a result, say, of another economic crash, that will just mean that these new sources of oil will be taken offline because they won't be profitable to produce at anything less than current oil prices.
Right. I mean, because that's really the key, is that there's a, you know, and once you start getting up to $100 a barrel, I mean, I've seen reports of there's also a push to recycle. To use recycled plastics and sort of get energy from that. But at the end of the day, this is we're basically at as cheap as it's going to get going forward. It's only going to get more expensive. It's just a question of at what rate and, you know, accounting for some small dips here and there.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it will be less affordable is a better way of putting it, because saying more expensive then gets you into a question of, well, what's a dollar going to be worth 5 years from now?
Right.
And so, but I think it's entirely defensible to say that oil is going to become less affordable as time goes on.
And so essentially your argument is, and it seems to make, you know, it seems, you know, fairly obvious, and particularly sort of even more obvious relative to how much it's discussed in the mainstream media. But if you take a literally the fuel that drives the engine of economic growth and you triple its price, I mean, we've over the past 10 years, right? I mean, oil is three times as expensive as it was.
In inflation-adjusted terms, if in nominal terms it's more like four or five times what it was, but in inflation-adjusted terms, about three times its former price. Yes.
So, I mean, what do you think? I mean, it seems quite obvious to me. I mean, just, you know, even if bandwidth, for instance, on my podcast, if it tripled or quadrupled in cost. It's going to seriously inhibit my capacity to grow this show. What do you think accounts for the fact that it's not discussed?
I don't know why it's not being discussed. It is pretty obvious. I mean, if you take money out of the pockets of consumers, they're going to have less to spend, and that's what's happened. You know, the housing bubble burst in 2007, 2008. The places where it burst first were the outlying suburbs, where people had to drive an hour or more to get to work, and they were filling up their big SUVs, and it was costing now over $100 to fill up the tank, and they were paying $1,500 or more every month just for fuel to get to and from work. Okay, well, those houses started losing value because people couldn't afford to pay for gasoline and pay their mortgages and their credit cards. And then the crash in housing values spread from there. As oil prices go up, that makes everything more costly, less affordable, and it takes money out of the pockets of consumers, and it makes the economy, makes economic growth harder to achieve.
And that essentially is your second D, right? I mean, it's depletion.
That's right.
Because there's a direct proportion, there's a direct relationship between depletion and expense.
That's right.
So let's go on to the third D.
This is a really cheery conversation, isn't it?
Believe me, it's hard to have other types of conversations these days.
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, this is the territory we're in. But you know, unless we understand the situation we're in, it's really hard to address it in ways that that really makes sense. The third D, of course, is disaster, and here I'm talking about natural disasters. Floods, droughts, and also industrial accidents like the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe of the summer of 2010 or the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe of earlier this year. These kinds of disasters are costing more every year. Now, intuitively, it seems strange because, you know, disasters have been happening forever. Earthquakes, volcanoes, you name it. Why should they be costing more now? Well, several reasons. First of all, there's more human infrastructure and more people in harm's way. Second, because of climate change, we're seeing worsening weird weather all over the place, and this particularly with floods and droughts. And then also, because as we search for oil and other resources in ever more desperate ways, we're having to employ technology that's at the absolute limits of what we're capable of, like drilling in 2 or 3 miles of ocean water. Right. Things are more likely to go wrong, and when they do go wrong, it's likely to cost more to clean up. So the result of that is that the total cost of natural disasters and industrial accidents is hitting new records every year. In 2010, it was something like $250 billion. In 2011, we hit that $250 billion mark in June. And I'm not sure what the total is going to be for the year as a whole, but it's going to be much, much higher than that. So that's making it difficult for insurance companies to evaluate risk. And it's also creating more and more growth problems for economies that depend upon agriculture. And of course, the United States is one of those countries, but there are many others, and also countries that depend upon food imports and where the price of food is a big factor in social stability.
So we've talked about all these things, and you know, like, what point do you get a sense that I mean, we're obviously there, and in terms of you know, the stagnant growth, and there are things that we can do. So you know, when you talk about the idea that some governments, and particularly ours, to take on more debt at this point is necessary to. Create these type of infrastructure, both sort of human infrastructure structural
built infrastructure.
Infrastructure. We don't really have a sense of when these things will conspire in such a way that they'll become. I mean, do you anticipate a time where everybody says, okay, now take for granted these sort of things? I mean, at one point, someone, I would imagine, you know, Brian Williams is going to get on the beginning of NBC News and say, you know, it's not just – I just found out today. It's not just that we're not properly educating people, and it's not just that we have globalization, but we're actually just sort of running out or – running out might be the wrong word, just that – we're running out of cheap energy, of cheap fuel, I guess. You know, we're not running out of fuel per se, although we are, but we're running out of really cheap fuel, and that's really the issue.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's. I think we can go on for a long time just playing whack-a-mole you know, looking at the symptoms and trying to deal with those and trying to find who's responsible and blaming different parties for why things are, seem to be going wrong in the financial world and in the social sphere and the political sphere and so on. And it's kind of tough for people to sort of sit back and see the bigger patterns and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we've built a whole economy around the idea that growth can go on forever, and we're starting to hit natural limits here, and we're really going to have to do something about, you know, the whole way we design our economy and what we're aiming for and so on. Those conclusions are not likely to come to people's minds right off the bat. The conclusions that are going to come to mind are, you know, who's to blame for this? So that's really why I wrote the book, is to try to, you know, connect some of these dots so that we can see that, yeah, there are evil criminals on Wall Street to blame. There are, you know, very foolish politicians who are saying stupid things. But in the end, you know, we're all part of this. We're all part of this economy that is trying to do something impossible. And we have to realign our measures and our goals. We have to stop aiming for constant increase in consumption and start looking at the quality of life and what we can improve, because there's a lot that we can still improve about our economy and our way of life. But I don't think we're going to be able to do it as long as we continue to assume that a rising tide will lift all boats, and, you know, to be wealthy is glorious, as the Chinese are now saying. That path got us through the 20th century, but in the 21st century, I think it's going to be absolute poison.
And now, obviously, this is speculation. But do you think that when you say that people aren't aware of this, I mean, do you think that it's that people aren't aware of this, or that that the system in which conventional wisdom is made is specifically maybe a strong word, is just not – there's just not the incentives to that are there to increase people's awareness of this? I mean, because, you know, I hear anecdotally from, you know people who are certainly more in touch with, you know, the Davos set than I am. But I hear from them that, you know, they're all those people are buying up huge swaths of land because they know that food
That's
is
right.
going to become an issue. That they are, in fact, you know, sort of aware of what you're expressing, but they see it as a market opportunity. We've seen, despite the fact that we have seen depletion to the extent that it is, I guess, I don't know if there's a one-to-one relationship, but we've seen depletion to the point where the cost of these resources have multiplied times 3 or 4 or 5. Yet,
right.
at the same time, we've also seen a similar increase in the profits of the people who sell these goods. This is for some a market opportunity, and for the rest of us, something that it's maybe better for us just not to appreciate is happening.
Yeah. What you're saying is I can generally agree with. There definitely are profits to be made on the way up. With economic growth, and there are those who will still be able to profit, at least to a certain extent, on the way down. And most of the people who are in charge of the economy really don't know what else to do. I was speaking at an investors conference in Hong Kong a few months ago, and this is something I don't usually do, by the way. But
well, they were smart enough to know that there was money to be made on the way down, if they know what the
That's what was going on. They wanted to know about global resource constraints, and there was a big discussion about climate change. And it wasn't how to stop climate change or what we need to do; it was about how to profit from it. You know, whether to invest in weather derivatives or whatever. So yeah, that kind of thinking definitely is very prominent, and once again, that's why I think it's so important to educate the public about what's really going on, so that we're not fighting at shadows, and you know, we can address the real problems.
And you know, and frankly, I mean, I'm I, you know, the behavior of the elite could also be like, you know, let's I want to cash in some of the chips while the while it's still open. So, all right, assuming that I have any listeners that have not now drunk themselves into a stupor you know, have decided to just double the dose of Ambien and take a nap for the next couple of days. What can we do as individuals beyond having an awareness that, you know, we can sort of prepare in some way? I mean, I sit here and I have a six-year-old daughter, and I am coming increasingly obsessed with not just the what the world is going to look like when she is my age, but what I can do to help her at that time.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot that we can do. I mean, we are headed toward an economy that is less based on money and more based on just interpersonal trust, getting along with each other, helping each other out, learning really basic survival skills, and looking out for one another. I'm talking about, you know, knowing how to grow more of your own food, you know, keeping chickens in the backyard if you got the space, sharing stuff with your neighbors, offering rides to people, because sharing is going to be the name of the game as time goes on. That's how we're going to get by. And, you know, in some ways it's going to make life better, because what we did over the course of the 20th century was we substituted professionalization for community. You know, we started paying people to do things for us that we used to do for ourselves or family or friends. And, you know, it enabled us to increase the number of hours that we worked, increase the GDP, but it didn't really make for better quality of life. So as the economy contracts, and as we depend more and more on each other, as we get back in touch with kind of the basics of life, in some ways, I think it's going to be really good for us. It's just, it will be a hard transition. You know, specifically, you know, I don't advocate, you know, going out and buying gold and silver. What I do advocate is going out and buying garden tools and getting to know your neighbors.
You know, it's interesting too, because there was a part of what you're saying there that you know, I just interviewed David Graeber, who is an anthropologist who was talking about early economies.
And, yeah, he wrote an excellent book.
Yes, and the debt, the past 5,000 years.
That's right.
Which people should read after they read your book, The End of Growth. But this notion of a more sharing-based economy, that this is nothing new. In fact, this is the way that economies functioned for, you know, thousands of years.
That's right. When we talk about the end of growth, sometimes people ask me, well, how could an economy possibly function without growth? And to which I answer, well, you know, all we're doing is we're getting back to normal. This regime in which we expect, you know, 3 or 4 or 5% growth every year is something completely anomalous in world history. Yes, economies grew before, but it's something like, you know, 0.01% per year, nothing like what we've seen over the past few decades. So we're just getting back to normal. And as I said earlier, that normal doesn't necessarily look so bad. How people respond to hard economic times is you know, very characteristic. You go back and you look at what happened during the Great Depression, during the two world wars. People grew more of their own home garden veggies. They looked out for one another. And they experienced more of a sense of community as a result.
And now we also have a government that has the capacity. It's just a question of where the priorities are going to go, that are going to be able to make up for some of those gaps, like you said, in terms of.
That's right. We still have an enormous amount of public wealth in this country. So it's a question of what we're going to do with that public wealth. Are we going to continue bailing out the banks in a fruitless pursuit of more economic growth? Or are we going to use that public wealth to support the population as we go through this difficult transition to a post-growth economy? And, you know, I think that the Occupy movement is extremely important in all of this, because it's a voice out there saying, hey, look, you know, maybe you want to continue bailing out the banks, but you got millions of people here who are suffering, and that we, the 99%, are not going to go along with this much longer.
And to a certain extent, what was happening in what is happening right now in the 60-odd encampments that still exist and in the encampments that were shut down is very much the type of sort of mini economies and mini societies that you're talking about are probably most likely our future.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've visited a number of those encampments. What I see is tens of thousands of young people getting a political education. I see people providing free shelter, free medical care, free food for one another. And it is creating a cultural shift. I mean, the people, the encampments can be broken up and dispersed, but the people who experienced what it was like to be in the Occupy movement are never going to forget that, and they're going to take what they've learned into their communities, and it's going to change things.
Richard Einberg, author of The End of Growth. We have a link to your book on our site at majority.fm. I really appreciate you taking the time.